In this episode, I will be engaging in a conversation with Taye Selassie. Taye Selassie really needs no introduction. Born in England to a Ghanaian father and a Nigerian mother, Taye Selassie is a multi-local of Accra, Berlin, Lisbon, New York City, and Rome. She is the author of the acclaimed novel Ghana Must Go and the children's book Anansi and the Golden Pot. In 2005, she wrote an instantly viral essay titled Bye Bye Baba, or What is an Afropolitan? This essay continues to be a subject of popular and academic debates today. In this podcast episode, Taye Selassie revisits some of the ideas that she laid out in that essay. She also touches on the continued relevance of a concept of Afropolitanism, and goes on to discuss the lives of African migrants in the US, especially in the context of her novel, Ghana Must Go. Happy listening. Once again, we really thank you so much for agreeing to do this with us. I think I've already introduced myself by email. I am a professor here at UBC, and I teach a third year English course titled Afropolitan Literature.
Oh, wonderful.
Ghana Must Go is one of the texts that I have taught over the years, and I teach it every year.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking or saying that actually this year marks the 10th year of Ghana Must Go after it was published. And, I know that I'm not the only one teaching it in, Afropolitan literature classes. So it's kind of like the novel has become a canonical text when it comes to, talking about the new African diaspora. And so I was wondering if you could talk about, and I know you know this, that Ghana Must Go is the go-to text when you talk about Afropolitan literature. So how does it feel that your novel is one of the path charting texts on the new African diaspora? And would you even use that term, the new African diaspora?
Thank you for the question, Dr. Sakou. Would I use the phrase new African diaspora? Sure, why not? African diasporas must be millions of years old by now, if we go back to the first exodus outside of Africa, yeah? And so I think it only makes sense to think about the demographics that come from and off of the continent in terms of their time and place. And it's definitely the case that the diaspora to which my parents belong is not exactly identical to the one to which I belong. It didn't necessarily cover the same ground nor set off for the same reasons. And so I do like the notion of a new African diaspora on the condition, I do accept the term of a new African diaspora on the condition that we understand that there will be a newer one yet, a newer one after that, and that we will always be replaced.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's so exciting. I was talking to another African writer in the US by the name Helon Abila, and he said, the new African diasporas,
exactly that
you realize it. And so, yeah, that's very insightful. Thank you. So, yes, it's been 10 years since Ghana Must Go, but also it's been 20 years since you wrote that seminal viral essay, Bye Bye Baba, or an Afropolitan. And the reason I started with the question of the new African diaspora is because I know that you use in your own work the term, the Afropolitan. And and you use that to describe diasporic Africans that you relate with, or whose experiences resonate with yours. And you use it to describe this highly mobile, highly transcultural global Africans. But the term, the Afropolitan or Afropolitanism, has come under fire from critics from all over the corners of the world, actually. Some say that it's elitist. Some say that it's too celebratory. Some say that it's very self-congratulatory. Some say it's apolitical, ahistorical. So I guess my question is that, almost 20 years later, that's this concept that critics love to hate. Do you still stand by the ideas that you relayed in the very first, essay? And would you actually agree with some of these critics?
I love that you ask whether I stand by the ideas relayed in the original essay, because I'm fond of saying that the essay has 1,000 words, 999 of which are often forgotten. So Afropolitan, as a sort of peel away from that essay, traveled the world, and I'm so grateful and glad that it did. The essay, though, took a very particular look at a very specific set of human experiences. Again, I'll use the plural as Habila encourages us to do. Why do I underscore that point? Well, nothing can be ahistorical that exists within history. I was writing about my experience, my cousins' experiences, our family's experiences, and those experiences, as you've noted, resonated deeply with certain Africans around the world. That my account of a very particular experience did not resonate with all Africans around the world should not surprise or alarm us. That it's the case, writing is in the end about specificity, at least the kind of writing I do. I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a marketer. I didn't come up with a brand or a tagline. I was trying to describe an experience, and I thought that Afropolitan was a perfectly suitable and evocative way to describe that way of being in the world. I still very much so do. What happened, I think, when the essay was published is exactly what should have happened. Those who could see themselves reflected in the words celebrated it. And between us, I don't think Africans can celebrate too much. And if we don't self-congratulate, I ask who will congratulate us? That is our work. And that is wonderful work indeed. But it's true that there were many who did not see themselves reflected in that description of a way of being in the world. And that's fine. I don't think the problem is that one person set out to describe one way of being. I think the problem is that so few of us are given a platform for our reflections. And so, not long ago, I wrote an essay called We Need More Names, arguing that the problem is often not with what an African writer has said, because I wouldn't be the only African writer to come under fire with exactly those same terms. The problem is not the observation, the problem is not the work, the problem is the limited number of us who get to have a say and not what I believe what is being said. And so I think we need more names. I think we need an essay about Afropolitan experience. I think we need an essay about 15, 50, 500 other ways of being African in contemporary life. That we don't have those is a huge problem, and one that I despair, and one against which I rail. The essay itself, though, stands for me 20 years later. I can't believe it. I obviously wrote it as a small child. The essay stands for me as an accurate description of one mode of being, and one of its chiefest critics, may he rest in everlasting peace, Binya, did me a great honor when he wrote on Facebook years ago that he had misread the essay and that he should have looked closer. And it touched me deeply that he was willing to go again and see how much melancholy and ambivalence and insecurity resonates throughout the course of those 1,000 words. It touched me deeply. It shouldn't be necessary, though, and on this point I will end and stand, that an African need to be melancholy, insecure, or ambivalent in order to be accepted as authentic.
Wow, thank you so much. That really fits into my next question, the melancholy and the ambivalence. But before then, I also just wanted to say that, in my Afropolitan literature class, I have students who whose parents migrated here, long time ago. They were born here, or or like and when they read your novel or when they read that essay or listen to the talk, Don't Ask Me Where I'm From, they're able to actually re relate with that. They come back and tell me that, okay, I have been struggling to fit, like, I'm not an African American, I'm not an Afro Canadian, and at the same time I don't have that very strong, deep, well, let me not put it that way. At the same time, maybe I haven't even been to Africa before because I was
Sure.
born here. So this Afropolitanism, kind of defines my experience, or I find it very resonating in so many ways. So there are so many students still after 20 years who
Yeah.
still, come to my class and say, wow, I have never come across this kind of material. This is what I have
Thank you.
looking for.
Thank you for sharing that with me. I mean, the sort of sentimental thing to say would be that I wrote the essay for those ones of your students. I wrote the essay for your students. I wrote the essay for those of us who felt in between. I've often said that at that point in my life, I felt stranded in a sort of anteroom in between four possible identities. One was British, I was born in London. The other was American, I was educated in the States. The other was Nigerian, where my mom is from. And the other was Ghanaian, my father's from Ghana. And yet, whenever I attempted to affirm a British, American, Nigerian, or Ghanaian identity, I was always told by someone, more often by many someones, that I wasn't that enough. Well, you're not British enough. You were born in England, but you didn't live there long enough. You're not American enough. First of all, you're not Black American. And then your family's not from here. You're not Nigerian enough. Your Yoruba is terrible. And you're not Ghanaian enough. You're too light-skinned. So there was always some claim to the, there was always the claim on the part of other people. This was the interesting thing that came to me with reflection. Other people often held themselves to be the authority on the authenticity of my identity. Now, that is something that many of your students, I'm sure, have experienced, and some have suffered, that someone else can tell you, you are not Nigerian enough, you are not Afro-Canadian, you are not this. I, in writing Bye Bye Babar all those years ago, was looking principally for a way to say, I am this. Whatever it was, whatever silly little name I might have come up with, the notion was that I wanted to feel that I was something and not only not X enough. Does that make sense?
It does. It does make a lot of sense, and I can't
Yeah.
wait to share this with my students. Thank you very
Oh,
much.
wonderful. Well, because the good thing, it turns out the good thing about coining a term is that nobody can tell you that you are not it enough because you have declared sort of a priori that you are that. And that is what I was looking for. I wanted to be something enough.
And I think the good thing about creating a concept like that is that, 20 years later, people are still kind of engaging closely and, even sometimes maybe tearing it apart, but they are engaging with it. And I think that's a good thing because there is something there, that makes it worth people's time, even scholars. So, and I don't see it like I think that people will continue to engage with it because it's such a very relevant and important concept that resonates with a lot of people, even if
That's
it
right.
doesn't resonate with other people. Okay.
Indeed, or if it doesn't represent them, because I think it's important to acknowledge again, a description of an experience will not be representative for everybody who reads it. And I think that we can't, I'm the last one who wants to paper over the incredible diversity that exists within African diasporas, but within Africans the more. And so I think that it's clear to me that that essay is very small in scope, probably compared to the billions of Africans who live in the world. Those who identify or self-identify as Afropolitan are quite a small number, and yet the effect for that small number, I think, has been large. The impact of finally seeing yourself represented. In 2005, when I wrote the essay, I didn't have Instagram. I didn't use Facebook, I didn't see constant visual representations of the kind of people I was talking about. And so when I say that I felt stranded, I mean it. I didn't look around and see Ankara print on every other bag and, nice glistening natural hair on every other woman. Far from it. I felt peculiar, and I think it comforts me, or I feel a sense of honor still now. In the mere thought that somebody else, stranded then or now, can turn to those words and feel, as F. Scott Fitzgerald put it, I'm not alone, I belong.
Well, thank you so much for that. And speaking of strandedness, and also what you've said earlier about people not reading or engaging with the entire essay, and I mean, there are people who engage in these debates who have actually not read the essay, right? So,
Indeed, so.
yeah. So I, you know, for you said in the you wrote in the eighth paragraph of that essay that quote, most anthropolitans are supremely self-conscious of being so in between, brown-skinned without a bedrock sense of blackness, often teased by African family members for acting white. The baby Afropolitan can get what I call lost in transnation, and that's such a end of quote. And that's such an that's so insightful and profound. And you know, you've talked about how Afropolitanism came from a stranded place. So I guess I just would like you to expand a little bit on that idea of strandedness and being lost, especially being lost in transnation, because we say that the Afropolitans are transnational, transcultural, but it also seems to be that there is a sense of loss that is attached even to that sense of transnationality or lived transnationality. So I was wondering if you have some thoughts to share on that.
Surely, I would call the Afropolitan multilocal for obvious reasons, but I would also note that it's true. The human being doesn't spring from the earth. The human being, as much as we love the abstraction of nation, comes from experience, as I've argued in my TED Talk, and comes from people, comes from relationships. But those relationships take place within place and time. And I think that place has a huge and can have a hugely grounding role to play in personal identity. When you don't have access to that, when I say I was born in London, that doesn't really give me a claim to that place. Or my mum is Nigerian, my father is Ghanaian. I been to Ghana almost every year for the past 30, and Nigeria is a country I know well, but I don't have the same claim that my parents have to the city, to the village, to the earth, and perhaps I never shall. And I think there is a sense of loss that comes with that. To grow up in a space, to look at your Canadian friends who feel as if they were cut out of the mountain face, to look at your American and British classmates who feel very much more so rooted within the regionalism of your adopted home, to look at your parents, to listen to the nuance with which they speak their languages, which they may have passed down to you, but not with the same precision. This justifiably and logically, I think, inspires a sense of loss because you are aware of what you don't have. It's also true that you've got something else. In not having such a fixed relationship with place or having had to forge an identity out of components that don't include roots or rootedness, I think people who identify as Afropolitan, certainly I, have been able to become more reflective on what it is to be from a place, have become perhaps more reflective on what it is to inhabit a space. And I think while, most forms of reflection can shade very easily into melancholy if left untreated, I think this one on balance is enriching and not just anguishing alone.
Wow. Thank you so much for that. I guess, you know, my next question is still kind of related to what we are talking about. I am wondering if there's also something particularly melancholic about movement, about mobility itself, not just to African immigrants. Because for me, my theory, when, you know, I have read Ghana Must Go over and over a million times now, and I feel like, you know, it's in three parts, you know, gone, going, and go. And the last time I read it, it just occurred to me that okay, gone could actually be referring to Kwaku's death, you know, in because that's when the it's in that first part, gone, that Kwaku dies, that we get to know that Kwaku dies. And then the second part, which is going, which is kind of present continuous idea of movement. Also, it's in that part that we see the family, the Sai family, as they strive, you know, even though they are very overachieving and sophisticated and all of that, but you could see the striving, and the toiling as immigrants or children of immigrants in America. So it's almost as if, that travel itself or mobility itself is a kind of death, not physical death, of course, maybe some philosophical, I don't know. And so I'm wondering that is there a kind of is there a kind of, I don't want to use death here, but the fact of mobility, does that have to do with, or just because of the way you've divided the book and the way that I have interpreted it, could traveling or mobility be linked or associated or typified as some sort of death?
I love the question, and I have to thank you for the elegant and incisive reading that gave rise to it. Truly, when I think back on writing the novel, which was more years ago now than I would care to admit, I remember typing gone. For me, just as you say, gone always referred to Kwaku's death. He's gone. Kwaku is gone. And in part two, I mean, in fact, you say he dies in part one. He actually dies in the first two words of the section in the first sentence of the novel. Kwaku dies is how the novel begins. And so he's gone from the very first sentence of the book. And then going is where we meet the family members he's left behind. So he's gone from them, but all of them by the end of that sort of snow chain of a section will find out that they're going to Ghana. They're going, in some cases, back to a country that they've been to before to bury their father, in other cases, for the first time seeing it. But they're going to mark the goneness of Kwikusai. And then in the third section, just as you say, go, the family is looking forward. It certainly occurs to me as Fola picks up Kwaku's slippers and brings them inside that this family is going to make it. They are going to go forward into their futures, whatever those futures may be, and they will not do so broken. They will do so as a family and as individuals, healing, if not whole. And so your reading touches me deeply, I have to say, because it is so closely aligned with my instincts
Oh,
as
thank you.
I remember them and as I was writing. So first of all, really, thank you for that.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really am so grateful.
Oh, that makes two of us. But to your question about death, and it's a powerful proposal you submit, which is that leaving that central concept of the novel is a kind of death. Surely it is. Kwaku, more so than Fola, because Fola was ripped out of her childhood by war, which so many are. Kwaku by lack of opportunity, by poverty and his unwillingness to live his life and to die his death in the same. But they both leave, and in so doing, leave behind the versions of themselves that might have remained, as previously discussed, more closely rooted in place, in space, and more embedded within a sense of home. Both of them leave, and in so doing, die to a life without homelessness. And I think many of us do that, and the lucky ones of us find a sense of home in some way or another. Where we land, some of us come back to where we began. Some of us find that sense of home within ourselves, within those we love, within our work, and some of us don't find it at all. But I think when you leave any place, to be honest, you die to the version of yourself that would have found a certain comfort or consolation in that place if it were available to you. And you are born into the version of yourself that must find that consolation elsewhere.
Wow, that's wow. I'm going to have to listen to this over and over again because I've that really profound insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to kind of move slightly a little bit to something else still about Ghana Must Go.
Please.
There is an instance in the novel where Olu's father-in-law to be, if I could put it that way, when he meets Olu and he says, Asians are no longer the model minority in America, and that Africans are. So this question I want to ask is kind of in it's two in one. So, is it true? Could we say that the Africans are the new model minority? Because I mean, Nigerians are the most educated immigrant group in the US now, right now, and almost every university department in America, you find an African professor. Africans shine bright in sports, in medicine. There is the global influence of Afrobeats. Also, I could go on and on about, the influence of Africans, in the North American culture and life, and but also I will bring it, home using Ghana Mosgo as an example. The Sai family, they are very successful. It's a very successful Afropolitan family until it is not. So, and I think that being successful, I don't know, maybe this is a wrong reading, is so much a part of the size, identity. And I think that's what Taiwo is trying to rebel against when she drops out of Yale. So, and one of my students actually made this argument that, it's that drive for success and overachievement that is the downfall of that family. That's, that's a student interpretation, which I find very interesting. So I guess, I would like you to elaborate on this idea of, the drive for success and achievement, and how that has to do with with the Afropolitans, but also, this idea of the Africans as the model minority. Is it something to embrace? Is it something to oppose, especially in the US context?
Very interesting. Well, I'm happy to speak about the profound and just incredible success of African immigrants in the United States context, as you've requested. But I will leave a I will I shall leave aside the phrase model minority, which I think is a bit of a trap. The success of certain immigrant groups in the United States has been observed by the writer. She is a sorry, I thought of her because you mentioned Taiwo dropping out of law school. Actually, she drops out of Columbia, but there's a Yale law professor, Amy Chua,
Oh
Amy
yeah,
Chua.
I know
Yeah,
that book.
you know it, and she proposes that there is a kind of triple package that certain immigrant groups possess. They've got a superiority complex. They experience paradoxically some sort of insecurity, and they've got high levels of impulse control. They are willing to experience delayed gratification. And I think she most certainly includes Nigerian Americans in that number, along with Chinese Americans, Jewish Americans, Iranian, Indian, and I think Cuban Americans, and perhaps the Mormons as well. In any case, Nigerian Americans are certainly front and center on that landscape. Insofar as it's true, yeah, we do believe we are superior. Many Africans come to the United States being told and taught of the exceptional nature of their work ethic, of their family, of their ancestors, as well we should, yeah. But then there is also a profound insecurity, and I think that's where a lot of the fragility comes from in the Sai family and in the migrant experience in general. Yes, you may have become a doctor, but as happens to Dr. Sai, a simple act of racism can cause you to lose your job. Yes, you might have come from rural poverty and worked your way into the American middle class, but it's a fragile middle class in the best of cases, and the more so if you are in a group that's discriminated against, quite frankly. Then there's this notion of being American at all. So you've come from the United, you've come from Nigeria, from Ghana, from Nairobi, from SA, and you're living in the States, you're living in Canada, wonderful. You've sent your children to school. You've browbeat them until they've come home with straight A's, which is the case for so many of us. Fantastic. They've gotten into prestigious schools and they've done well. Wonderful. But who do they believe they are? Who are you telling them that they are to become? That sense of delayed gratification, I think most Africans full stop, and then African migrants, we've mastered that. We understand you stay up in the library now, you work hard now, so that you can enjoy later, but you're not really being sent to uni to enjoy today. Everybody gets that. But what are you being sent for? There's a moment in the novel in which rather, I should say, at different points in the novel, each of the four side children begin to question, why did our parents not tell us where they were from? Why do we know so little about our grandparents? Why do we know so little about the cultures that our parents call their own? Why do we know so little about who we are in the world beyond this pursuit for American achievement? And I think that is a different kind of insecurity than the one that Professor Chua writes about. I think this is an existential insecurity. I think this is a very deep spiritual fragility, which is the work of an oversight, of a profound oversight on the part of many well-meaning African parents. And that oversight is simply to remind your children that you come from a place worth remembering, that you come from a place worth celebrating, that even if you left it because of war, because of poverty, because of lack of opportunity, it wasn't all bad. It wasn't all lack. There was material poverty, perhaps, but that existed alongside profound and ancient cultural richness, profound and ancient spiritual wealth. And to forget in the midst of the hustle and bustle and the grind of life in America. So I say forget, I use the word benignly, though the consequences I think can be tragic, to forget to tell your children that they were wealthy before you were poor, that they are spiritually and culturally rich in addition to being academically gifted and hard striving. This is an oversight which I think is at the very, very heart of the melancholy. And so hats off to your student who mused and wondered, was that drive for success part of what caused the unraveling or the dissolution of this family? Is it part of what drove Kwaku's shame? Is it what made him unaware that he had so much more to give his family than his job as a surgeon, than his renown as a doctor, and then his success in America? I think they were right.
Wow, thank you so much. Yeah. You know, they were wealthy before they were poor. That was wow. That was a punchline there. I had to laugh because there is a I mean, from what you were saying, there's something that comes to mind. And I want to quickly ask it before I ask my last question.
Please.
I'm struggling to articulate it, which is that okay. The drive for success, or the success of African immigrants in North America in general, I think it's also to a very large extent useful, precisely because of the narrative, the dominant narrative. Before, things are changing now, right? But you know, there was a narrative about Africans, you know, and how backward, and some people still hold on to those
Oh,
narratives.
there is. I think it's a little too early to start using the past tense on
Exactly,
that
right? So I feel like this new narrative of like successful Africans in
one.
all sections of the American society or Canadian society is I think it's equally important. But I guess how then to hold that, knowing that it's complicates what it means to be African in the world, and at the same time not fall into what you call the model minority trap. Is the question, you know, how do you do that?
You have to, I think, understand your identity beyond material achievement. I know that sounds perhaps sentimental, but I could not mean it more. If the entire project is to become a successful and a well-paid doctor or banker or professor or engineer, the project is flawed. The entire project needs to be to become a self-actualized, fully realized person at home in the world, knowing themselves at home in the world. And I think that as Africans confronted for so long and burdened for so long with the limiting and limited expectations and perceptions of others, we've been reactionary, we've been forced to be reactionary for so long. We can wrestle against the notion that Africans are inferior, or we can reject it wholly within ourselves and get on with it. That's not to say, and certainly I hope that the novel, along with my TED talk and its concern with restrictions or the Afropolitan essay and it's concerned with strandedness. That's not to say that material difficulties don't exist. They do. They do. I don't mean to say this is an inside job only, but it begins there. And I think understanding that we are not inferior, understanding that we are in so many ways superior, reaccessing some of this ancestral wisdom and ways of knowing that we claim and include as our inheritance, starting there and making sure that that project runs parallel to the American success operation, I think that is critical to coming out on the other side whole, or as I say, at the very best, healing.
Well, thank you very much for that. I guess my last question is the question of generationality or generations, you know, of African immigrants or African immigrant experiences in the US and everywhere else in the world. And you did mention it earlier in this talk about how, you know, the children of immigrants, their experiences are different, you know, from their parents, you know, who immigrated in the first place. So and you could see this also in Ghana Mosgo, right? Kwaku and Fola, they had their challenges, which was mostly economic, you know, trying to make a living and you know, provide for their family. But the children, you know, they had a different kind of challenge, which was not economic, at least in the way the challenges their parent faced. You know, I feel for example, Sadie and Taiwo, especially, Sadie and Taiwo, they were more burdened by the question of identity and self-understanding. And you know, so on the one hand, the children of immigrants, as we see in your novel, they inherit their parents' fears and anxieties. But on the other hand, you would think that these children would have a less complicated relationship with America in this context, because that's where they were born. But it seems that they are the ones even more burdened with the question of race and belonging, as we see in Sadie and even Taiwo to a large extent. So I'll be, you know, grateful if you could touch on these differentiated experiences of immigrants and their children, you know, to their host nations. And also another, you know, layer to that question is, you know, the Afropolitan's attitude to race.
Ah, that's interesting. You know, you've a few times now referred to Ghana Mosgo as an Afropolitan novel, which I'm prepared to accept. But it is certainly the case that the size are not Afropolitan characters. Neither Kwaku and Fola, who, as you've just astutely observed, come from a different generation than their children, but neither I think Olu Taiwo Kainde or Seti, because in many ways their concern is not that of place. They are stranded in many of the ways in which I am or was, and in the way that I sort of define as foundational to the Afropolitan experience, whether experienced as a suffering or otherwise. They are stranded, but I think, just as you say, their concerns lie elsewhere. One of the things that I think I may have wanted to do when I was writing this novel was to claim a space for African characters to be emotional, to be sad because they are in love with their best friends, to be mournful because they had an ill-advised affair with their dean, to be suicidal because they believe they broke their twin's heart, to be uptight because they want so much to be like a father they love and hate. I wanted the interior lives of these characters to be as blazingly important, to be as worthy of our attention and our close reading as the political circumstances of their parents' countries. And so in a very defiant and indignant way, I think I set about considering what is hurtful to these characters on the most microscopic, at the most microscopic level. And I don't know if that is just a question of generationality. Certainly it is an indulgence and it is a privilege to spend most of your day thinking about your emotional state rather than your economic one. You know, I'm often asked when I speak with the doctor about the fact that I suffer from depression. They'll say, "Did your parents suffer from depression?" And I'll say, "I don't know. They were too busy." But, I'm only half joking. It's true that there is a privilege to being able to suffer at all. And yet, it's a privilege that I wanted to grant these characters. They hurt, they ache, they cry, they complain, they're petty, they make mistakes. And that was so important to me, as my project was to consider their very humanity.
Wow. Yes, just as you were talking, I that was your last word now is humanity, and I was just thinking in my mind that you were making them human, and
That's it. That's it. I mean, that is the work of every novelist, is to make your character human. And the challenge I think that the African novelist faces is the pressure from without to be not just a novelist, but a sociologist and a political scientist and an anthropologist and, a marketer and a forecaster as well. But we're not. We are, at the end of the day, involved with the interrogation of human experience. That's the job we've chosen, or the one that has chosen us and hasn't let us go. And I think it's worthy work. I think it's work that I feel honored to do, and it's work that I take terribly, terribly seriously.
Wow. Thank you so much. So yes, I think at this point we should we don't want to take all of your time. We are so
Oh,
busy
it's such a
with
pleasure.
us right now. If you don't mind, would you like to read any, some passage?
Sure, you asked me to read from page 117 of, I hope you meant of the paperback. This is where Olu is speaking with Dr. Wei. Is that the, do we
Yes.
have the same? Okay, good. It suddenly occurred to me you might have meant something else. And I will, I'm happy to do so.
Yes, thank you.
Forgive me, I've got a little bit of a cold, so I'm just going to take a sip water. Okay, so in this scene, Olu and Ling had gone to see Dr. Wei, presumably to tell him that they're engaged, but things don't go quite as they anticipated. So speaking first is Dr. Wei. He says, "Speak English, my dear. There's a guest in our house." "Our house," said Ling, "is on Huntington Avenue." "Well," said her father, and said nothing else. Olu shifted positions, wishing Ling would let go, feeling incarcerated rather than claimed by her grip. Ling was against it, he spoke up politely. "But I thought it only right that we ask, that I ask." "For my daughter's hand in marriage," Dr. Wei said bemusedly. "Which one?" "Of your daughter's?" Olu frowned. "Of her hands. The one with the ring would appear to be taken." "I knew you would do this. I knew it," Ling seethed. "And it's not your decision. I've already said yes. I told you." She turned to face Olu. "Let go." Olu, ungripped, felt his stomach turn over. Dr. Wei smoothed his hair down and said, "Well, I see." Ling stood abruptly and left the room crying, her small shoulders shaking. A door slammed somewhere. Then Dr. Wei laughed, rather shockingly, warmly, a rich and deep sound in the space Ling had left. He took off his glasses and wiped them off, tearing, more rumbles of laughter than smiling. He spoke. "I'm laughing at myself. I should have known this was coming. Ling's mother always said you were friends. They're just friends. For 15 years? No, I don't think so." Another rumble. "So often one knows without seeing the truth." He put on his glasses, looking closely at Olu, smoothed down his hair again. "Olu, yes?" "Yes." "I knew an Olu. Oluwaleku Nobayomi." He pronounced the name correctly. "Nigerian, as you'd know. Top of our class at UPIT by a long shot. It's not that I'm racist, far from it. Sir, please." He nodded, as if agreeing with himself to continue, and crossed his legs, crossing his hands on his knees. "It is true that you don't have my blessing and won't have, but not for the reasons that you may suspect, certainly not the reasons that she does, that Ling does." He glanced at the hallway down which she had stormed. Olu shifted too, but to settle in, listening, lulled by the cadence, the professorial tone. Odd how this happened, even now in his 30s, this defaulting to student at the first sign of teacher. "When I was in grad school in Pittsburgh, fine city, I befriended a fair number of Africans, men, all of them men, unsurprisingly, engineering, just grown-up boys playing with toys." Sipped his tea. "They'd come from all over, some wealthy, some destitute, but all of them brilliant, pure genius, those five. The hardest working men in our cohort, I tell you, all bafflingly good at the maths, smoothed his hair. Americans call Asians the model minority. At one point, this may have been true, recent past, but now it's the Africans. I see it in the classroom. Asians are through. We got fat. No, don't laugh. You never saw an overweight Asian, not young ones, not back when we came, when the girls were still young. I see them all over now, Koreans, Chinese, on the train, on campus. It's the beginning of the end. A fat Asian child can win a spelling bee, maybe, but a science fair? No, it's the Africans now. I'm serious. You're laughing. But Olu couldn't help it. Dr. Wei started also, his deep, bossed gong laugh. I say this to say that I admire the culture, your culture, its respect for education above all. Every African man I have ever encountered in an academic setting excelled, barring none. I have never met a single lazy African student, or a fat one for that matter, in 40 years here. I know it sounds crazy, we laugh, but believe me, I teach undergraduates, I see it every day. African immigrants are the future of the academy. And the Indians. He paused here to finish his tea. I'll skip ahead. You know, though I never understood the dysfunctions of Africa, the greed of the leaders, disease, civil war, still dying of malaria in the 21st century, still hacking and raping, cutting genitals off, young children and nuns slitting throats with machetes, those girls in the Congo, this thing in Sudan. As a young man in China, I assumed it was ignorance, intellectual incapacity, inferiority, perhaps. Needless to say, I was wrong, as I've noted. When I came here, I saw I was wrong. Fair enough. But the backwardness persists, even now. And why is that? When African men are so bright, as we've said. And the women, too, don't get me wrong, I'm not sexist. But why is that place still so backward, I ask. And you know what I think? No respect for the family. The fathers don't honor their children or wives. The Olu I knew, Oluwaleku Nubayomi, had two bastard children, plus three by the wife. A brain without equal, but no moral backbone. That's why you have the child soldier, the rape. How can you value another man's daughter or son when you don't even value your own?
Wow. Wow. Thank you so much.
Which seems like such a down place to end on. Hang on a minute. Let's hang on, hang on. We
Okay,
can't stop there.
okay. All right.
Let's go to Kwaku's death scene. Let's go out on a slightly cheerier note. Okay, so here we are. Here's this father who did in fact love his wife and did in fact love his children, about to die. Here we go. He does not think what he thought he would think, that he never said bye, or that it goes by so fast, or that he should have chased Olu down the stairs when he came, or seen Sadie grow up, or not driven away. He thinks that he was wrong about the whole thing being forgettable. Not that he won't be forgotten, he will, has been already, but about the details being unremarkable, what it amounts to in the balance. There is one detail worth remembering, that he found her in the end. Folashade Savage on the run from a war, Kwekusai fleeing a peace that could kill, two boats lost at sea, washed to shore in Pennsylvania, pencil wherever, of all places, freezing to death, alive, in love. Orphans, escapees at large in world history, both hailing from countries last great in the 18th century, but prideful, braver, hopeful, and brimful and broke. So very desperately seeking home and adventure, finding both in each other, being both to each other, the nights that they toast with warm Schweppes and cheap flutes, or make love in the bathtub in moonlight, or laugh until weeping, that he found what he hadn't dared seek. When it would have been enough to have found his way out, to have started where he started and to have ended up farther, a father and a doctor, whatever else he's become, to have dared to become, to escape would have sufficed. To be free, if one wants swelling strings, to be human, beyond being citizen, beyond being poor. It was all he was after in the end, a human story, a way to be Kwaku beyond being poor. To have somehow unhooked his little story from the larger ones, the stories of country and of poverty and of war that had swallowed up the stories of the people around him and spat them up, faceless, nameless villagers, cogs, to have fled, thus unhooked on the small SS sigh for the vastness and smallness of life, free of want, the petty triumphs and defeats of the self, profession, family, versus those of the state, grinding work, civil war. Yes, this would have been quite enough, Kwaku thinks, born in dust, dead in grass. Progress, distant shore reached, that still farther past free, There lay loved in her laughter, lay home in her touch, in the soft of her afro. He almost can't fathom it, had never dared dream of it, believing such endings unavailable to him, or to them who walked shoeless, who smiled in their deaths, and who sang in their dreams, and who didn't much matter, that he found her and loved her and made their love flesh four times over. It matters, if only to him, a point to the story, that girl child met boy child and loved him, even if he lost her. So he starts to rise up to go kiss her in the fountain, not to behold or to be held by, but to hold her, or tries. He makes it as far as a sort of push-up position before his valves lose the plot, and so to death. He lies here face down with a smile on his face. Now the butterfly alights, finished drinking. A spectacular contrast, the turquoise against pink, but unconcerned with this, with beauty, with contrast, with loss. It flitters around the garden, coming to hover by his foot, fluttering its wings against his soles as if to soothe them, open shut. The dog smells new death and barks, startling the butterfly. It flaps its wings once, flies away.
Wow. Thank you very much. That's a good way to end rather than the present.
We can't let Dr. Wei's word be the last one.
Yes, I agree completely.
It's been such a delight to speak with you. I'm so grateful to you for making this happen. I know it took a lot of doing, and it's just your reading of the novel is it's extraordinary. It's inexplicable, actually, as somebody who wrote it, that somebody who read it can understand it as profoundly as you do. And I really cannot thank you enough.
Wow, thank you. Like, wow, it's an honor, you know, doing this. Like, I mean, I'm awestruck and starstruck and all of this at the same time. So thank you so much for your kind words. Thank you for listening to this podcast. We would like to hear from you. So please send your comments, suggestions, and questions to the New African Diaspora Podcast at gmail.com. We're also open to collaborations and sponsorships. If you're interested in any of that, please reach out to us again through the New African Diaspora Podcast at gmail.com. Finally, I would like to thank all the writers who made themselves available for these interviews. I would also like to thank UBCO Studio for giving us a space to record all the podcast interviews. I would also like to thank Taylor Wilson, Donna Langille, and Marco Adrico for their relentless support in ensuring that this project came to life. Thank you. Bye.